Please be advised that the opinions and views expressed by Richard Martin of GF Investment Services, LLC are entirely his own and do not necessarily represent the views of the company, its affiliates, or its officers. Investments based off of Richard Martin's comments are unsolicited by the company and are at the sole risk and prejudice of the listener and the investor.
A very good morning to you all in the United States from me, Richard Martin, here at the wake-up call from Singapore on this Monday, the 2nd of July, 2012. Well, just this moment, about less than 30 seconds ago, we got the report in of the ISM manufacturing, which was down much worse than expected at 49.7, below 50. This is recession territory for the first time, ladies and gentlemen. The expectations were for 52. The stock market just gave a tremendous sigh of, it fell, I would say, probably 80 points in about 32 seconds. Let's get to work very quickly. I don't want to waste any more time here. I want to talk about what happened on Thursday night, which made the market go up 270 points. Shame on it. You know, people are asking if Europe has finally been saved this time, whether the latest so-called breakthrough solved the European debt crisis. Of course not. And you should know better by now than to ask. Well, let me very quickly give you the terms of this new agreement that was thrashed out until 4:30 a.m. on Friday morning. The bailout money for the European countries will be provided from the European Stability Mechanism, that's the ESM, which is a bailout fund with much of the money coming from Germany. Who else? In previous bailouts, the money was loaned to the country along with demands for austerity measures such as raising the retirement age, privatizing public sector businesses, or cutting the number of public sector workers. The big change in this new agreement is that the ESM will lend the bailout money to the country's banks rather than to the countries themselves, so that the loans will not have to appear and the countries will not have to go into bankruptcy and into insolvency. And basically, that way there are no nettlesome austerity requirements and no increase in the country's debts. Isn't that nice? The banks can then use the money to buy the country's bonds, thus pushing down bond yields or interest rates. And Spain's 10-year bond yields have recently been about 7%, and Italy's about 6%, rates that are, of course, considered unsustainable. Well, with interest rates lower, the countries will be able to borrow more money by selling more bonds. Thus, Germany will be indirectly purchasing other countries' bonds, which Angela Merkel had said would not happen in her lifetime. This is what's being called a growth pact. But it will not create one iota of growth. It will simply permit profligate behavior to continue. Friday's euphoric market reaction worldwide is based on the fact that all this new liquidity will enter the marketplace, and as usual, it will enter the American stock and bond market, pushing prices up and bond yields down. The can has been kicked down the road for a few extra weeks, making the problem worse than ever. The people of Europe these days are extremely anxious and scared because they can sense that the financial system is collapsing and that all the politicians are lying. Now, the recent Barclays Bank revelations of massive fraud by arrogant banksters, which, by the way, I probably won't have time to get to today, but that has confirmed the public's worst fears that there's nobody left to be trusted. This, of course, is all part of the generational change in attitudes that are taking place at making any kind of growth pact worthless. Increasingly, people today don't trust anyone, and so banks are not willing to lend, businesses are not willing to hire, and ordinary people are not willing to go further into debt. That's the generational change in attitudes and behavior that's triggering the deflationary spiral and the worsening financial crisis. And ladies and gentlemen, to repeat what I have said many, 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 many times over, there is no solution to this crisis. Yes, it can be postponed, which will only make it worse, but the worst simply cannot be prevented. Well, now, I can rant on and on, and I do intend to rant a lot more before this show is over. This should be quite a hot one, so, you know, button down your belts and, you know, fasten the seat belts and get ready for it. But first of all, I'm going to give you some relief, because I'm going to have a clip played for you, which is Carl Denninger, who is a really astute analyst that I follow religiously every single day, and he is talking to my absolute favorite financial interviewer of the moment on RT television called Lauren Lister. And I am going to play you just a few minutes to get for you to get a flavor of someone else's take on this European situation right now, because I think, you know, it gets a little heavy when I go on all day about it. So let's hear from Carl Denninger, and he is talking to Lauren Lister. Off we go.
All right, let's switch gears. Let's talk about Europe and what the big deal was about this summit that's still going on, or it was today at least. This is what the president of the European Council says.
We agreed on something new, which is a breakthrough, that the banks can be recapitalized directly in certain circumstances.
But what kind of breakthrough is that? Is that a good thing that there's a green light for direct bank bailouts in some cases, as they've agreed upon in Spain? Doesn't that just mean the debt is being shuffled around but not getting dealt with? What kind of a fix is that? Carl Denninger is going to tell us. He's trader and author of Leverage, How Cheap Money Will Destroy the World. And Carl Denninger, what was this big breakthrough and solution? Just buying Spain and Italy a little more time?
Yeah, pretty much. There's no breakthrough and solution at all. I mean, you've got two facilities to do this with, the EFSF and the ESM, one of which doesn't have any money in it, or essentially none, and the other of which hasn't been ratified yet.
Right, not even in Germany.
Yeah, so there's no money in one, and there's not a lot of money in the other. And the best part of it is that major parts of the contributions to go into these funds are going to come from the nations that are in trouble and are going to allegedly be bailed out. So this is very much like me taking a $20 bill out of my left pocket and putting it in my right pocket and claiming I'm $20 richer. That doesn't work.
No, it doesn't work. But does it fool the markets for a little bit? And are we seeing a point of diminishing returns with these can-kicking efforts?
Well, sure. And this is a big announcement, so you got a big pop.
Today in the market.
Yeah. So the market goes up, and everybody cheers, and everything's fine. Watch the bond rates over in Europe. They were down big today. All right, that's to be expected. But see how long they stay down, because what has happened is every time they come out with another one of these deals, we get, you know, a few days, sometimes hours or minutes in a couple of cases, and then the markets are selling off again because people say, well, wait a minute, if I buy Spanish debt, how am I ever going to get paid? If all these guys are doing is shuffling money around, then at the end of the day, how are they going to pay me back? And what you have with Spain, Ireland, and Italy is a situation where all of these governments, you know, despite the fact that they all claim, well, austerity, you know, can't be done, the truth is that government cannot spend more than it takes in taxes, whether it's here or anywhere else. And when you do that, what you're effectively doing is destroying the purchasing power of everyone in the nation. Mm-hmm. So you can temporarily try to make up this black hole that you've created, but over time, How do you sustain an economy if the power to purchase things is being destroyed by everybody that's in the economy?
Mm-hmm.
Well, sooner or later, you run out of money,
right?
And that's when it all comes apart.
Okay. And as far as the bond market, it seems like they need more and more of this drug of short-term fixes or short-term boost in confidence to get the same effect of not pushing Spain to unsustainable levels in their borrowing. As far as any kind of long-term fix about what you're talking about, which is the dynamic, that doesn't exist, does it?
No. There's been nothing that actually addresses the root cause of the problem, which is that the people in these nations, and here in America for that matter, need to have an honest conversation with their government. What services do you want government to provide to you? And then you have to pay taxes in order to cover all of those, not tomorrow, but in today's money.
Mm-hmm.
So that means that some part of the money you earn by going to work and doing your job has to go to the government to pay for these services.
Mm-hmm.
And if you're not willing to pay the taxes, then you don't get the services.
Mm-hmm.
That conversation is one that's very hard for politicians to have, because if you say to the Greeks, for example, fork up 25% of your income, or this particular program is going to go away, they say, well, we're not going to pay.
Mm-hmm.
And they have an underground economy and they evade paying. And then they cook the books to make it look like everything is okay when, in fact, it's not.
Mm-hmm. Well, I don't hear any of those conversations. I hear banking authority. I hear 120 billion euro for some kind of a growth program. I mean, even if these things are decided upon long term, are they solutions?
No, because what has happened is the banks have financed, in other words, brought forward the ability to have things today to be paid for tomorrow. But unless you can find a way to pay for them tomorrow, all that's happened is you've increased the total amount of debt, and no matter how low the interest rate is, you've increased the amount of interest you have to pay.
Mm-hmm.
Okay? So over time, this problem becomes worse. And this is why we continue to see the same dynamic play out. Yes, you get a little bit of relief, and then people start thinking about it and say, wait a minute, the debt is now, you know, went from 62% to 72% of GDP or whatever it is. That means that the interest that's going to have to be paid is greater than it was a month ago. Why do we think that this should add confidence? This should subtract from confidence.
Mm-hmm.
And it does.
Well, European leaders have held 18 summits since the beginning of the debt crisis. After most of the preceding summits, global financial markets responded with joy because European leaders had reached a deal which would supposedly solve the crisis. But a few weeks after each summit, it would become clear that nothing had been solved and that the financial crisis had actually gotten even worse than before. How many times do they expect us to fall for the same sorry routine? Nothing in Europe has been solved. You can't solve a debt problem with more debt. European leaders are just kicking the can down the road. More debt will relieve some of the short-term pressure, but in a few weeks it will be apparent that the underlying problems in Europe continue to grow. Now, unfortunately, there isn't an unlimited amount of European Union bailout money, so once all of these financial bullets have been fired, European leaders are going to find that kicking the can down the road will not be so easy anymore. The truth is that the financial crisis in Europe has not been cancelled. It has just been put off for a few weeks. Clearly, you do not solve the problems of a credit card addict by giving that person another credit card. You may delay the short-term financial problems of the credit card addict by giving that person another credit card, but in the process, you make the long-term problems even worse. And that, ladies and gentlemen, is essentially what is happening in Europe. European governments and the European financial system have become ridiculously dependent on debt. By giving European debt junkies another hit or two, it may relieve a bit of short-term suffering, but it doesn't solve anything. Just think about it. The first bailout package didn't solve the problems in Greece. The second bailout package didn't solve the problems in Greece. Today, the Greek financial system is a total mess. And Greek politicians are saying that a third bailout package may be necessary. Many are claiming that Italy and Spain have been saved by this new deal, but that's just a joke. The ability to inject bailout funds directly into troubled banks is going to keep some of them going for a little while, But the deal also calls for a new governing body to be established that will supervise those banks. Will that governing body be established in time to even provide the short-term help that's needed? Spending bailout funds to buy up Spanish debt and Italian debt may artificially suppress bond yields for a time. We've seen this before. But then, after the bond buying program was over, bond yields started spiking again. The Europeans obviously don't plan to suppress bond yields forever. There's not enough bailout money to do that. Okay, let's review the equation that I've mentioned in the past, primarily designed for those challenged in algebra and also those of an optimistic disposition. Brutal austerity plus toxic levels of government debt plus rising bond yields plus a lack of confidence in the financial system plus banks that are massively over-leveraged plus a massive credit crunch equals a financial implosion of historic proportions. None of those elements have been removed. Bond yields will be suppressed for a period of time, but that will not last forever. And all of the other underlying issues are still there. Meanwhile, the rest of Europe continues to follow the Greek economy into economic depression. The Spanish economy shrunk again in the second quarter of 2012, and austerity in that nation has barely even begun. As a recent CNBC article detailed, the big spending cuts are still coming. The conservatives, who inherited from the outgoing socialists one of the Eurozone's highest public deficits at 8.9% of GDP in 2011, have said that they will shrink the shortfall to 5.3% this year and 3% in 2013. Austerity has absolutely shredded the Greek economy, and we're starting to see that same pattern being repeated all over Europe. When you spend far more money than you bring in for decades, eventually you have to go through a very painful adjustment. What's going on in Greece should be a lesson for all of us. Debt allows you to live above your means, but the consequences of going way into too much debt can be absolutely horrific. More debt can delay the consequences of a debt problem, but it cannot solve a debt problem. Finding a way to get the banks to borrow even more money, which was the main plank of the so-called breakthrough agreement early on Friday morning, is not solving the problem. It's making the problem worse. People need to stop spending money they don't have. The solution to too much debt is not more debt. All this little agreement does is give them, the banks, a chance to have even more debt for a while longer. But if you just went by the headlines in most of the newspapers around the world, you would think that European leaders had discovered the cure for cancer or something. In fact, they're just choosing to fire off a few of the financial bullets that they still have left, as a recent Washington Post article described, and I quote, "The European bailout funds don't have unlimited resources. If they throw $125 billion at Spain's banks and another couple of hundred billion towards Italy, pretty soon they'll be running low. The only entity with unlimited euros is the European Central Bank. And right now there's no talk of using the ECB to provide bailouts, which means that this latest move might just have forestalled the crisis rather than ending it permanently. The future is, in fact, more dire than ever for Europe. There is no more collateral, so no more LTRO. All of the swill loans have already been hocked. If they try to cut ECB percentage rates, it won't matter. It won't change conditions in Italy or Spanish funding markets one bit. A spending plan of less than 1% of GDP won't put a dent in the recession that's building. And if Brussels tries to buy more sovereign bonds to avoid a catastrophe of Italian tenure exceeding 7%, sorry, there are wise men in Germany who simply will not allow this to happen in the scale that's required. And if the ECB goes DEFCON 1 and launches an E2 TQE program, that won't happen either for the same reason. Merkel will absolutely not embrace Eurobonds. No chance in hell. The US or China will not start buying European Union bonds. The International Monetary Fund will not come to the rescue. It doesn't have the resources to solve anyone's problems. In other words, kicking the can down the road is going to get quite a bit harder after the current sugar high wears off. Europe is still headed for the greatest financial crisis in its history. And European leaders are powerless to stop it. Of course, the United States is also facing a crisis of too much debt, and a great day of reckoning is on the way for that country as well. The global economy is still heading for a collapse, and there are many reasons to be extremely concerned about the second half of 2012. Well, not good news, ladies and gentlemen. Absolutely not good news at all. And I'm sorry that this has happened in the way it did, because it was completely unnecessary. But that's the way, unfortunately, that these things work in finance, it seems to me. And I don't understand why. I don't understand why the economists don't nudge these politicians and these financial bigwigs earlier in the day. I just don't get it. It was clear to me way back, as those of you who've listened to the wake-up call for several years can attest. And yet these people just willfully push themselves deeper and deeper and deeper into a hole. You know, debt can be expanded at a rate that exceeds the rise in real income in only one way: by lowering interest rates so the same income can support a large debt, which, of course, is the reason the Federal Reserve has lowered interest rates to near zero with ZIRP, or zero interest rate policy. Eventually, the buyers of newly issued debt at near zero or even negative yields start to fear they will never get their capital back, or they will be paid back in depreciated currency, and so they demand a higher yield. Now, since income has already been stretched to the limit to support a towering mountain of debt, this rise in yield catapults the borrower into insolvency. That is the story of Greece, Spain, Italy, and eventually the entire debt-dependent global status quo. Well, if the standard financial wisdom is true, that surviving a financial catastrophe requires a six-month cache of emergency savings, then two-thirds of Americans may be in for a nasty surprise. Only a quarter of U.S. adults have more than 6 months of funds set aside and readily accessible for such disasters. 28% had none at all, according to Bankrate.com. Of the 1,000 survey respondents, 17% said that they had 3 to 5 months of expenses squirreled away in case of job loss, sudden medical bills, or other expected events, or unexpected events, I should say. 9% didn't answer the question. A similar report earlier this year found that 43.1% of Californians have little to no financial cushion when factoring out homes and other assets that can't be quickly or easily converted into cash. Retirees are better prepared. More than 4 in 10 have at least 6 months of financial buffer, according to Bankrate. Less than a quarter of whites have no savings stash. 38% of non-white respondents are in the same boat. Republicans are less likely than Democrats and independents to be caught in the cold. At least more people than not feel increasingly stable in their jobs. About a quarter said their sense of professional security is increasing from a year ago, compared with 16% who said the opposite. Men tended to be less worried about their status at home than women. Same goes for net worth. More than a quarter of adults, more men than women, believe that their total assets minus debts are currently higher than they were 12 months prior, compared with 20% who think their value has declined. Younger respondents report being better along than their older peers. And there you have it. All right, ladies and gentlemen, let me give you my information, which is boringly the same, I suppose you could say. My name has remained Richard Martin since the beginning, and presumably will do so until the end, whenever that is. Richard Martin it is, therefore. The show is called The Wake Up Call, and it's coming to you from Singapore via the good offices of PRN in New York City. The toll-free number, in case those of you who have never heard of a toll-free number would like to know what it is, the secret is out. It is 888-874-4888. I shall repeat, 888-874-4888. Please use it. It is there for your edification. If you would prefer, however, to write in an email with your questions, comments, rants, criticisms, whatever it may be, please feel free to do so. My email is open at all times. And it is as follows, rm@gfawd.com. RM stands for Richard Martin. GFAWD stands for Global Financial Advisory Wealth Design. GFAWD.com. And if you would like to call me in private to discuss your own individual problems or economic conundra of one sort or another, please feel free to use my direct line through Sarasota, Florida at area code 941-441-1682. That, again, is my direct line number at 941-441-1682. And that number is available 24 hours a day. If I'm not here, please leave a message, leave your name, your phone number, and I will call you back. Once more, the number is 941-441-1682. Okay, so please be aware that the next meeting of the Richard Martin Meetup Group in New Brunswick, New Jersey will be on July the 22nd. That will be a Sunday, July the 22nd at 2 p.m. at the usual venue, the George Street Ale House, which is at 378 George Street, no less, and it is within walking distance of the railroad station or will provide you with plentiful parking of a Sunday afternoon, should not be a problem. Lots and lots of people are really talking about moving more and more. After the break, I'm going to read you really a very touching story, courtesy of Sarita, who has figured widely in recent wake-up calls here about her move to Cuenca in Ecuador, and people have asked to be filled in on more of her details. So I've got quite a lengthy email from her, which I am looking forward to sharing with you after the break. But basically, ladies and gentlemen, as I've said before, be it as it may, that things can be better or worse in other countries than the United States, but no country is going to suffer as big a move from wealth to poverty as America. And it is going to be very, very hard to tolerate. And many people will have a very hard time with it. And that will make the country virtually unlivable, in my opinion. Never mind the economic breakdown, whatever may come with it. Have a look at Greece to see that. But also look at Greece to see the heartbreaking story of how people's lives have been ripped asunder by the depression that has come to visit with a vengeance. And on that note, ladies and gentlemen, I think we will stop for our break. I will be, as always, right back. Okay, so we're back, and as promised, let me give you the wisdom from Sarita, who is actually writing this email in response to somebody who had specifically asked the question as to why she decided to go and live in Ecuador, and she wrote back something quite unexpected and very, very interesting, and so I'm going to let you know what she has to say. This is Sarita, who used to live in New York City and made her decision along with us. She went to visit the meetup group in New Brunswick several times, and now she is living happily in Ecuador. And so here is what she has to say. Dear Richard, today I listened to your show and was most touched to know that there are people out there who would like to know why I have chosen to make Ecuador my new home. To understand why I chose Ecuador, maybe it would be useful to provide a little background about myself. Many years ago, my father left Romania at the age of 15 to seek a new life for himself. He got on a boat and went to South America, where he could have chosen any of the five countries that Simon Bolivar had liberated. South America prided itself in being open to any seeking a new life, unlike the United States, which had a very limited quota for new immigrants. Because my father didn't understand Spanish, he wasn't aware of on board time, and so was left at the aptly named Buenaventura, Good Adventure port in Colombia. This small detail led to his destiny of settling there, and that is why I was born in Bogota, Colombia. About 10 years later, in 1937, he already knew of the impending likelihood of war in Europe, since he heard rumors in the cafes, the equivalent to PRN and the wake-up call of years ago. He had heard of Hitler, and so he returned to Romania and begged his mother and other family members to leave and travel with him to Colombia. At this time, he already had a business and was wealthy enough to provide for their transition. His brother-in-law, a writer, said that he had already traveled to South America and that he would not go to live in such a wild and savage place. He would stay in civilized and advanced Europe. My father's mother said she would stay with her daughter and grandsons. Soon after that, they all went to a concentration camp, and my grandmother died there of starvation. On the return ocean voyage to Colombia, my father met a woman who was living in Poland with her three daughters, part of a big number of people leaving Europe, grateful to be on board, even if it meant not having a cabin and sleeping outside on deck. This was one of the last ships to leave Europe before World War II erupted. The oldest girl, Ruth, was to become my mother. I grew up in Colombia and as a teenager had the privilege of going to a boarding school in the USA. I also attended university for 2 years, so all that time in the United States cemented my love for this country. I then returned to Colombia, where I got married. It was most evident to us that in Colombia, the only people who could succeed economically were those that owned businesses. Professional people, like physicians, could look forward to a relatively nice life with much respect from the community, but with very little in the area of being well remunerated. The knowledge of being put into a financial situation where there would be little progress economically, and seeing that if I was to be a doctor's wife, my future would include having to dry the diapers on a line in the living room, told me that my future children would be born in the United States, where we would have the opportunity of being part of the upper middle class. At that time, the requisites for a doctor to become a resident in the USA were many, and my husband, a physician, agreed that it was best to leave Colombia. We had many obstacles to overcome, but we finally became residents, and 5 years later, citizens. The second factor for our move to the USA was the fact that at that time, so many people were being kidnapped in Colombia, and so safety was a major concern. We knew that in the U.S., people kept their doors open at night, children played outside by themselves, and kidnapping was simply non-existent. We moved, and our life was indeed wonderful in every single aspect. We achieved the American dream in a big way. Our 5 children had opportunities they would not have had if we'd stayed in Colombia. Now, decades later, it has all changed, and again, I am reliving the fractal established by my father of having to move to find a better way of life. Just as my father left to find a new continent, and I left for the United States as a young woman, now I find myself fleeing the U.S., a country with growing economic hardships, limited opportunities, and strife. Paradoxically, I'm being drawn towards a quality of life that drew me to the U.S., a society which I fell in love with in the 1960s. Ecuador seems to be a wholesome, hardworking, and developing country where people are waking up to the fact that they have a richness of resources, not just in minerals, such as oil, water, agriculture, and gold, but in an awareness of what they possess as a culture. They too get global news and are aware of the devastation in the world, both climate-related, economically and socially. Therefore, there is a growing sense of pride for their heritage and what they have. Yes, they embrace the modern, but they're not throwing away the old traditions. Before arriving in Ecuador, I did consider returning to Colombia. Unfortunately, issues of safety and expense are still problematic there. I am very happy with my decision to live in Cuenca, a small city designated by UNESCO as a World Heritage Site. The climate is perfect spring weather every day of the year. The town has 4 beautiful rivers crisscrossing through it. It is completely surrounded by mountains, and one doesn't have to go far to see properties with cows, horses, sheep, and roosters. There are many universities, and there is a very young, dynamic feel here. The mixture of Indian, Spanish, and European influences creates an intellectual milieu where cultural events are plenty. The advantages far outweigh any disadvantages. For example, it is a bit of a challenge to get to Cuenca. One has to take 2 planes and 2 days to reach this town. Then there is the issue of the altitude, which affects many people, regardless of how fit or old they are. Back in New York, I could no longer justify paying more than $2,000 a month on rent for a tiny one-bedroom apartment on Roosevelt Island, just off Manhattan. I am retired and have my Social Security check, which in the USA doesn't go far. With this money, here I am living very well. Just last week, I went to see an apartment that consists of 3 bedrooms, 3 baths, a large living room, dining room, and large kitchen in a modern doorman building. The rent there is $350 plus $62 for the condo's common charges, and $38 a month for the television. Water and electricity are maybe $10, for a total of around $460 a month. This is just one example of what it costs to rent. If you rent a furnished apartment of 3 bedrooms, 2 baths, plus a maid's room with bathroom, including the utilities, plus television, that can cost you $650 a month. Food is most inexpensive, and a wonderful vegetarian lunch costs $2.50. On the other hand, if you eat meat, you can find a steak lunch for $1.50. Oddly enough, it costs more to be a vegetarian. Then there are benefits of living in a place where the daily paper devotes part of the front page to local shows and musical events. Yesterday, I attended a magnificent concert at the University of Cuenca, which had the National Symphony of Ecuador with renowned guitarist Serge Lopez as their featured guest. The performance was free of charge. For July 4th, we will hear an opera by Pergolesi. Although I did live in New York City, I couldn't enjoy many of the concerts and operas because of the exorbitant ticket prices. Here, this is no longer an issue for me. Cuenca is currently undergoing a facelift. The infrastructure is bustling with new construction. In an area called Gringoland, they're building a new highway with an underpass which will also have the first tramway. It must be finished by November the 3rd. If not, the penalty will be enormous, for the construction company will deliver the highway exactly on time on that date. This kind of project would most likely take years in the U.S. Here, it is a matter of months. Lastly, I want to comment on the gentleness of the people here. In 2 months, I haven't heard a child have a meltdown, nor have I heard a parent raise their voice to any child. Everywhere you go, you see people carrying their children and frequently kissing them. These children are growing up feeling very loved and therefore lacking nothing. People here are quite amazing human beings, genuinely at peace and happy. I feel as if I had gone back in time to that era of the 1960s when life was so good in the USA. Life is really good here. Very few walk around lost in their cell phone conversations. People have time to talk to each other, and no one seems ever to be in a bad mood. Everyone smiles, and it is a genuine smile. As a newcomer, I feel a wonderful sense of community among the expats. We have many venues where we meet. There is a daily website called Gringo Tree, which gives info on all the activities that are going on. Here, you also get information on who to call for anything you may need, and in general, is a great resource. There is an established structure of support which makes it so easy to make friends here. No matter how much I tried, I didn't know my neighbors in all the years I lived in New York. Finally, I do feel at peace, knowing that I live just a few minutes away from beautiful organic farms. If ever there is a shortage of food in the world, for sure it won't be here. Drinkable water comes down from the Cajas National Park, just 15 minutes from here, which supplies the city with its water. It is a gorgeous place, 14,000 feet high, where even at this time of the year, one sees snow. Everywhere you look, there are waterfalls, and that water is pure. Last but not least, I sleep well, knowing my expenses are quite minimal and the rewards of living here quite plentiful and abundant. I don't need a car, and the buses cost me 12 cents as a resident senior. For me, choosing to live in Cuenca has been a wise decision. May this information help those of you who are thinking of leaving the U.S. and considering leaping into a new life south of the border. If any of you do come to Cuenca, I will be most happy to show you this wonderful place. Regards, Sarita. Well, Sarita, it really does give me great pleasure to thank you for that extraordinarily heartfelt email, and I hope many of you will take it to heart and will basically use it in the spirit in which it's meant. I don't often read emails either of that nature or of that length, but I felt that this is the kind of thing that really makes it very easy for you to discover something new and something which will perhaps make your lives more wholesome, and it will certainly make your tax liability much less. You will not be paying the taxes of people for the rest of your lives, especially if you do agree to renounce your citizenship, which I'm not necessarily recommending, but it's a way to avoid having to pay down the irresponsibly taken tax liability of the current generation after 10 years. It will take you 10 years to, as I understand it, to work off that tax liability, but it's at least something. Well, ladies and gentlemen, let me see. James Dellingpole, writing in the Daily Telegraph, had the following 10 observations about the United States to make, which I thought worthy of bringing to your attention. Number one, only in America could the president talk about the greed of the rich at a $35,000 a plate campaign fundraising event. Two, only in America could people claim that the government still discriminates against black Americans when you have a black president, a black attorney general, and roughly 18% of the federal workforce is black, while 12% of the population is black. Number three, only in America could we have had the two people most responsible for the tax code, Timothy Geithner, the head of the Treasury Department, and Charles Wrangel, who once ran the Ways and Means Committee, both turn out to be tax cheats who are in favor of higher taxes. Four, only in America can we have terrorists kill people in the name of Allah and have the president and the media react by fretting that Muslims might be harmed by the backlash. Number five, only in America would we make people who want to legally become American citizens wait years in their home countries and pay tens of thousands of dollars for the privilege while we discuss letting anyone who sneaks into the country illegally just become American citizens. Number six, only in America could the people who believe in balancing the budget and sticking by the country's constitution be mocked by the president and labeled extremists by the media. Number seven, only in America are you required to present a driver's license to cash a check or buy alcohol, but not to vote. Number eight, only in America could the president and the media blame oil companies for gouging the public because of the price of gas went up when the return on equity invested in the most major oil companies is less than half that of a company making tennis shoes, Nike. Number nine, only in America could the government collect more tax dollars from the people than any nation in recorded history, but still spend over $1 trillion more than it has per year, while the president complains that there is not nearly enough money to do what he wants. And number 10, only in America could the people who pay 86% of all income taxes be accused by the president of not paying their fair share on behalf of the people who don't pay any income taxes at all. Well, I thought that was quite a nice one. And as always, some food for thought. All right, well, let me see if we have something else in the way of an email, and we do. We have an email from Steve Kruger. It's a little bit old. It's been around since about 2 weeks, but I think it's not old enough for casting into the trash. So here it goes. This is an email from Steve Kruger as follows. Richard, I can't get your closing words of the 1st of June asking for some thoughts on, of all things, conspiracy theory out of my head. First item to concede is how far back in time to go to find the original conspirator. I would think you have to go back to 1913, to the creation of the Federal Reserve. The vote to give life to the Federal Reserve and the Federal Income Tax Act was taken on the 23rd of December 1913 in a practically empty Congress. This was a very deceitful way to do business. Most of Congress had gone home for the Christmas holiday, which at the time, 1913, the trip home was done by train. no JetBlue, and took days, not hours. This left mostly yes voters allowing this to pass. Without a Federal Reserve, there would be no debt problem. I have to ask, are the 12 Federal Reserve banks part of what is called the cabal of world bankers? Also, a question that needs an answer is, if this conspiracy started in 1912 and all the original conspirators died, what is the glue that holds the conspiracy together in 2012? To me, if we have a conspiracy at all, it has to involve thousands of people. And again, what keeps it together? What keeps the players anonymous? Can the glue be fear? A fear of your life? The life of your loved ones? Also, a large question is, who benefits from a worldwide depression? How can bankers profit by holding mountains of paper money not backed by gold? Is America's gold gone? Is the world's gold gone? Who knows? Perhaps there is a second conspiracy that actually wants to reduce the world's population. Wow, this gets weird fast. If the binding factor that keeps this all together is a form of religious belief or some form of devil worship, a cult in so many words, then when not limited by time, we can go back thousands of years. Richard, this is really getting weird. Could it be this goes back to 325 AD, when Constantine handed off the Roman Empire to the Roman Catholic Church? Richard, it's so simple to call this a conspiracy of stupidity, but in doing so, you must accept the coincidence premise. I just can't see all this as coincidence. It's just too much to accept. It's the easy way out. Maybe one of the wake-up call listeners can make a connection between conspiracy and death wish. I bet there is one. Steve Kruger. Thanks for the wake-up call and the headache. Oh, Steve, you're very welcome, and I'm very glad to be able to do justice to your emails, which are really excellent and well worthwhile. I get an email from Al Berry, who says, "Dear Richard, what is your opinion of moving to China? How can I find out where I can open a bank account in Chinese currency if I do not move to China? Thank you, Al Berry." Well, Al, and I know this is about the third or fourth time you've sent this email, and I'm terribly, terribly sorry. I really haven't, it's not been that I just haven't got, you know, wanted to give it an airing. It's just that it just got lost in the mix. I don't know why. So thank you for repeating it again. And I think the answer to your question is that I don't think you are able yet as an individual to open an account in Chinese renminbi, although I think they are allowing Hong Kongers, to residents of Hong Kong, to do so. But they are the first Westerners to be able to do this, as far as I know. And as a result, I think that you will have to wait a while. But if you really want to badly enough, I think you might want to contact the Hong Kong consulate or the High Commission or whatever they have by way of representation and find out if there is a bank that will allow you to open an account in renminbi. But again, being a non-resident of Hong Kong could add to the difficulty. So you may have to wait a while. But yes, you are right. The Chinese are loosening up the convertibility of the local currency, and they're using Hong Kong as the kind of gateway, the window, if you like, to the West. So I think very soon it will become a convertible currency, and I think and hope that that will take care of the problems that the American government have with the Hong Kong, with the Chinese trying to manipulate their currency. So anyway, that hopefully has answered your question. And again, apologies for the tardiness of same. All right. Well, this is just about the end of our little time together. So let's finish with a new song called Fiscal Cliff by Merle Haggard. And while we're at it, Merle has this message for you. Though I'm a country singer, I also love surf-style music. The only thing wrong with the genre is that these songs are always, of course, about surfing, as well as teenage romance and drag races. There should be more on macroeconomic topics and political economy. So I'd like to do another one like Fiscal Cliff, but I'm out of ideas. I'm hoping NewsHour audience might help. I have in mind a song contest. Submit a topic, a key phrase, or a whole lyric, whatever you like. The Making Sense team and I will jointly select the winner. Assuming we get a good idea or two, I will turn it into an original song. There is no money involved, as the market for econ surf songs is somewhere between inactive and inconceivable. But the winner will garner internet fame on Making Sense, perhaps even go viral, and then will in any case earn a heartfelt thank you from me. At the very least, you should have fun and a story to tell. All right, ladies and gentlemen, that's it until Friday. Have a great 4th of July, everybody. Bye-bye. Till then.
What will happen if we hit the fiscal cliff? It was a sunny day down in Washington. I took my Chevy out for a spin. While I was stopped at a light, I saw some cars to my right, and then what happened nearly did me in. House Speaker Boehner pulled his wheels next to Senator Reid's, and then they got into an awful tiff. So Boehner said, let's fight, and Reid said, yeah, you're right, let's have a drag race to the fiscal cliff.
Fiscal cliff.
Fiscal cliff is a danger zone.
Fiscal cliff.
It's where grown men go when budgets are blown.
Fiscal cliff.
If our senators cannot agree,
fiscal
they make
cliff.
Massive cuts automatically.
Fiscal cliff.
Default.
What will happen if
we hit the fiscal cliff? It was a game of chicken. I was really scared. I didn't want anyone to die. But Boehner revved it up and said keep taxes low. And Reid said no, we must keep spending high. And then it finally happened, what I always feared. And yeah, it looked as bad as you would think.
Look out.
Our elected reps skidded out of control and drove their cars right over the brink.
Fiscal cliff.
Fiscal cliff is a danger zone.
Fiscal cliff.
It's where grown men go when budgets are blown.
Fiscal cliff.
When our congressmen cannot agree.
Fiscal cliff.
Taxes go up automatically.
Fiscal cliff.
When the budget talks or come to a halt.
Fiscal cliff.
People go there and they threaten default.
What will happen if
we hit the fiscal cliff? Well, officer, my memory of that day has never gone away. I often find myself thinking, what if? And what I've realized is if they'd only been wise enough to compromise, well,
one, two, three.
They could have saved us from the fiscal cliff.
Fiscal cliff.